This is Under the Radar with Aaron, and I've got Jonathan Eisen on the line, editor of Uncensored Magazine. So, John, when you tell people you edit a magazine called Uncensored Magazine, what's the basic blurb you give them? Give us that easy blurb that everyone will know what it's about.
I don't really have one.
That's good.
The title says it all. There's no blurb. It's just that if you're fed up with the trash that you've been fed in the mainstream media, the garbage that passes for news and analysis, you might want to have a look at Uncensored, because it might just open up your eyes to a lot of the stuff that's being distorted or kept from the New Zealand reading public.
So the implication of calling it Uncensored is that the rest of the media is actually censored. Can you explain that? Is it censored? Is it self-censored? Is it censored from outside?
Well, if you go, yes, absolutely. There's no question about it. Without sounding too paranoid or conspiracy theorist about the whole thing. And I have worked in newsrooms, and I've done stories for 60 Minutes and Holmes and New Zealand Press Association. I've been around the traps for about 35 years or more, and I've seen it up close. The fact of the matter is that there is a box that if you're a professional journalist, you fit comfortably into, and you don't go outside that box, regardless of how intriguingly interesting, truthful, or revelatory the stories happen to be. If those that you're sitting on, there is every newsroom from the Herald on down or up, depending on how you look at things, is controlled in one way or another by either advertising pressures, which come down to you directly from the publisher, your managing editor, or the editor of the day. I can give you many examples, or from your own self-censorship, over a period of time, what's going to be acceptable, what's going to advance your career, what's going to get you in trouble, that kind of stuff.
Okay, well, give us one example.
I call up Martin Johnson, who's the so-called health editor of the New Zealand Herald. And I say, Martin, I got some very interesting stuff here on X vaccine and its relationship to, say, autism, or let's just call it a spade a spade. The MMR vaccine and its relationship to autism, and this is bona fide stuff. It's published in the Journal of Adverse Drug Reactions, which is published by Oxford University Press. The whole ball of wax.
Yep.
It's straight skinny. It's legit. Johnson says to me, he says, are you part of the anti-vaccine lobby? What organization do you belong to? And I say to him, I'm not a member of any organization, and that's true, I'm not. Regardless of the fact that no organization would probably have me as a member, but that's another story. I'm not a member of any organization. He knows it. That's his knee-jerk reaction. And I said, no, I'm not. Do you want to see this? It's very, very interesting stuff. It's coming out of some peer-reviewed journals in the United Kingdom, and it's a hot story. Not only does he not want to look at it, much less print it, his knee-jerk reaction is that if it's questioning the value of this very expensive campaign promotion that was happening at the time. By the way, Merck Sharp and Dohme was the manufacturer, and their profits from that particular vaccine were $900 million a year. Hey, money talks, all right? And that talking money goes all the way down to Martin Johnson. Sue me, Marty. It's the truth.
What are you saying? The implication of that is that he's getting money for not printing.
No. What I'm saying is that he's the end of the feeding chain. He knows. Intuitively, he knows what's going to be acceptable in the Herald to publish and what's not. All right?
Okay.
And that's only one example of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, maybe thousands of them that occur every year. there are awards that are given in the United States for the most censored stories, most important censored stories of the year from journalism schools. Here's another one for you, Aaron.
Okay.
1994-5, I'm the publisher of Auckland Institute of Technology Press, AIT Press. I come out with a book called Suppressed Inventions. Bloody good book, if I say so myself. The journalism class, one of the journalism classes there, want to interview me, right?
Yep.
So they go to their professor, and they say, we want to do a class project interviewing John Eisen as to whether or not there's any validity to these stories that he's published in Suppressed Inventions. The journalism prof says, yeah, go right ahead. The dean at the time cancels the interview. No, you can't go talk to John Eisen, you can't interview him, no, that's off limits. This starts in journalism schools.
Isn't that what the school is for, though?
The school, yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that the journalism schools and the so-called journalists in this country and the United States and to a large extent England and Australia act as gatekeepers, all right? They're not there to reveal the truth, to dig hard, to really find out what's going on. If, God forbid, they stumble on a story, their knee-jerk reaction is to become balanced and get the other side so that they don't appear to be biased. Okay? Never mind that they might be digging out something that's really, really important. No, sir. The whole idea is to deliver markets to advertisers. Got that? Markets to advertisers. That's what journalism has become.
Okay. All right, so that's a good explanation. Now tell us how this magazine came about. I'm sure you've been dying to publish something like this for a long time, so how come it's happened now?
Well, I've been living to publish something like this for a long time. I've been waiting for 20 years since I got to New Zealand for a really good alternative magazine that really told it the way it was. And I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and it hadn't happened. I was introduced to Steve Crowe by a mutual acquaintance, and Crowe said, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to do this magazine. And he said, yeah, all right, well, I'll finance it. He did for the first issue. We actually sold out virtually every copy that we printed, which was 10,000 copies. Now that you can't get one for love or money, there's no copies left. What we're going to do is sell the issue on CD for people who want to get it that way. But it's out. There's nothing.
Some of it's also on the website, isn't it? On your
website? Yeah, we put uncensored.co.nz is a very popular website that we started. My web genius tells me that we have about 140,000 hits as of last week, we sold about 9,700 copies of the print version of the magazine, and we're starting to attract some attention from the mainstream. The editor of Canvas, which is the New Zealand Herald Sunday magazine, on her front page decided to tell her readers that she thought that Uncensored should be censored. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Well, it's nice of them to just come out and say it quite clearly.
Yeah, it is. It is good. This is a magazine that basically teaches people new ways to make scampi and the latest fashions that some anorexic models are wearing, and you know, that kind of crap. That passes for news. I mean, it's all infotainment these days, and nobody takes the reader seriously. Nobody says, hey, we have some readers there we have a responsibility to, and that responsibility involves telling them the news, what is really happening, opening things up to controversy. Now, this is why the Internet's become so popular, because these damn newspapers and TV stations have let down the entire country, man, in their quest for market share. They're just businesses. People should realize it. The same way they should go to their doctor, they should realize that their doctor's just a businessman, too, or woman.
Well, we'll get to that, but I wanted to ask first. Did Canvas magazine call you a conspiracy theorist?
Oh, I don't remember if.
I've noticed that. I've seen Uncensored mention in a couple of places. And yeah. They usually use the phrase conspiracy theorist. Now, it's not meant as a compliment.
No, it's not.
It's a derogatory term. So yeah. What do you say to that?
Indeed, I am a conspiracy theorist. I take theories about different things, including conspiracies. I track them down. If they're factual, I print them. If they're non-factual, I file them in the little round filing cabinet on the floor. And that's the way it is. Sure, everything starts out as a theory. Everything. You have a theory about stuff. I have a theory that New Zealand iron sands could be made into really good neodymium magnets in China. That's my theory. Oh, I track it down. Lo and behold, that's exactly what they're doing. All right? That's become a fact at that point. All right? Now, you can say the same thing about conspiracy theories. But the fact of the matter is that term is used by people who don't want other people to track down the facts of any given issue. Consequently, they, and that includes this bogus operation called the Skeptics Society. By the way, and the skeptics refuse to debate me anytime I challenge them. So much for that kind of nonsense. They've decided that calling somebody names is an adequate substitute for actually getting down and finding out what the facts are. I find that not only alarming, but definitely deleterious to the future prospects of this nation as an entity that contains a lot of people who can actually think for themselves.
Okay. The cover of the magazine's got, was 9/11 an inside job? Was it?
Of course it was.
And who?
There's no question
and what's,
about
who,
it
who's,
now.
Who's on the inside? Who are the people on the inside?
Well, I think we all know that at this point. The vice president in charge of torture, his name is Richard Cheney. Hopefully, in the not-too-distant future, he will be tried as a war criminal. Donald Rumsfeld, who himself admitted that it wasn't a plane, but it was a missile shot from a jet. It was a missile that went through the Pentagon, not a passenger plane. I've got the quote. George Bush, who... basically is somebody, the front person who can't walk and chew gum at the same time, but, you know, the state of American democracy has fallen to such a level that most people really didn't notice that the guy was somewhat to the left of Whoopi. Wolfowitz, who's now the head of the World Bank, Douglas Feith, who was part of the inside job a training center, all the people who were members of the Project for a New American Century. Dial up PNAC on your Google, and you'll see that in 1997, these same people who are now running the American government were actually calling for a Pearl Harbor-like event in order to galvanize public opinion for the takeover of the oil fields in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere, to get the backing of the American people. They really needed a horrific event, which turns out to have been supplied to them on September 11th.
Okay, now, for a lot of people, it's actually a new idea and a pretty radical idea that Dick Cheney is the mastermind behind 9/11. Do you want to just go into that a little bit, give us some background so that... people might start to feel at ease with that idea, if that's possible.
That Cheney was running the thing?
Yeah. Tell us about that.
God. It's long, it's torturous. Oh, I use the word advisedly, and involved. However, to break it down into bite-sized chunks, Cheney basically goes to Haifa, Israel, in 2000, and he makes a speech and he says, "Your foreign policy is our foreign policy. Basically, whatever you guys want, we'll do." And the Israelis go, oh, let's, I like the idea of taking out Iraq because, gee, that's could be a serious enemy. And, you know, they're interfering with our Middle Eastern hegemony. And Cheney hooks up with the right-wing Likud people and that other war criminal whose name is Ariel Sharon. Sharon, by the way, can't go to Belgium because he's, you know, there was a standing indictment for him for the massacre of those poor people in Lebanon that he oversaw. Okay, so you got these two war criminals conspiring together, and that's item number one. Item number two, and by the way, the Israeli connection to 9/11 has yet to be explored adequately in the mainstream press. However, there are heaps and heaps and heaps of articles on it, all of them, oh, well, most of them, I should say, very well documented on the Internet. And I would take this opportunity to encourage your listeners to dial up RENS, RENSE.com, and Arctic, ARCTIC, Beacon.com, two very, very, very good websites that have done an amazing job revealing some of the machinations of this Machiavellian cabal that Cheney is the head of. I don't know how much longer I have. I should go on about Mr. Cheney, but there's an amazing amount of research that has been undertaken and never published in New Zealand, of course. But it's all there on the Internet, and some of it's there in uncensored. Our website details some of it as well, again, uncensored.co.nz. But Cheney, this morning, once again, Colin Powell's exec assist, Wilkinson is his name, has gone on record once again as implicating Cheney in the whole disinformation campaign to lead the United States into war on Iraq, you can't get more establishment than that, nor can you get more establishment than this guy. His first name escapes me, last name Hutton, Hutton, who was the chief of staff to Republican Senator Robert Dole, who was also a candidate for president, and Hutton likewise has brought a lawsuit. I shouldn't say likewise. Hutton brought a lawsuit on behalf of the families of the World Trade Center victims against Bush and Cheney, and he said in his lawsuit deposition that basically it was an inside job. You can't get more establishment than those two people, Powell and Hutton. And there are many others, some of whom I published in this issue. If this is news to your listeners, that only means that their sources of information have been heavily censored.
Well, I expect that for a lot of people it is news. Or perhaps what is news would be that there is reliable documentation for this, which is what you're saying.
That's exactly right, Aaron. I took this reliable documentation to my former... he was my editor of the New Zealand Press Association. I said, when are you going to run some of this stuff? And he said, oh, I don't believe the Americans would do that to themselves. So he didn't even look at the evidence. His name is Ian Stewart. He's the Auckland Bureau Chief for the New Zealand Press Association. Nice guy, Stewart. Love the guy. He's really, really good. Very good with the nuts and bolts, only if it's outside his comfort zone, as this certainly is, he won't even read it. Now, he is the gatekeeper for information that millions of New Zealanders rely on for to make up their opinions on what's really happening.
Well, what would happen to him if he did print the stuff that you
I have no idea.
Him? I mean, you might expect that would be the end of
his
career.
He'd be called a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
He'd be sidelined and marginalized the same as I was. This is what's truly dangerous, Aaron, and that is we have an entire culture that doesn't worship at the feet of the truth, but is a careerist-oriented kind of a matrix, if you will, where certain ideas, regardless of how well documented they may be, certain facts are just beyond the pale. Simple as that. And that, and if those events, facts, ideas, theories, whatever, no matter how well documented, are not accessible to the people of this so-called democracy, what does that tell us about the future of our democracy? If I could take that and just make an aside here, for 3 years I've been pushing the idea of binding citizens-initiated referenda, BCIR, direct democracy.
Yep.
Because it's clear that we don't have democracy in New Zealand or the United States. But, I mean, representative democracy is hardly democracy, is it? What I noticed in the last 3 days was that Switzerland, which has binding CIR, citizens-initiated referenda, where the people get to write the law and vote on it, has just declared that Switzerland will have not a bar of genetically engineered crops growing in their country. They have voted on a 5-year moratorium, and that's it. And regardless of the millions of dollars that were spent by the biotech companies to influence the Swiss, they voted a sizable majority, 55%, against GE.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I've done a lot of stuff about GE on the show, and I've had people come into the studio after the show say, you know, what are coming to talk to a guest? What about, why don't we have a referendum about this issue?
That's right.
And I don't think anyone involved in the GE movement in New Zealand is terribly interested in it.
I was, and I still am. But
if it's not a binding one, I mean, you know, where's it going to get you? That's a lot of work, right? It soaks up a lot of activist energy, all for nothing.
That's right, because our referenda law from 1993 doesn't have the provision in it to make the decision binding.
So why did you want to? Why do you see a point in having a referendum then?
I don't want just an empty referendum that means nothing. I want a binding citizens-initiated referendum, binding on the government. I think that we should have revisit the 93 law. Say there's whatever the trigger number is necessary to initiate that into a binding, whether it's 300,000, 100,000 signatures to put that on the ballot, okay, whatever that turns out to be, okay, fine. But the decision of the people has to be binding on the government. Then it becomes real and meaningful.
Personally, I can't see that happening. I mean, that's a bit harsh. How would you see that actually happening? I mean, there's a reason they didn't make that law in the first place.
That's right.
I mean, how would you get that to happen?
Well, the first thing that I did was I published People Power.
Yeah, which we interviewed you about.
Yeah, and the reason I got into binding CIR was initially because I read that the Swiss were going to have one on GE, and I'm so adamantly opposed to GE, I thought that would be the way to do it, because this government clearly is pissing in the pockets of the biotech companies. I thought that that was, I thought that was highly dangerous, and I've been vindicated by recent studies that show exactly how dangerous it is. I don't have to go into that now, nor do I want to. But your listeners should I think now that the Swiss have spoken, start revisiting the idea of a binding CIR in this country. I think it's the only way that we can really start regaining control over the decisions that are really important for our lives.
Okay, well, let's get back into into the magazine.
By the way, I have a very good article in the coming issue about some of these safety studies that have been done on GE food, and it's bloody scary. It really is. And I'm not going to quit pushing this particular barrow, nor do I think anybody should, because like John Carapiet and Zelka Grammer and others around the country, this issue is just too important, and it's not going to go away. One of the reasons I'm doing Uncensored magazine is because, once again, the mainstream media are not dealing with this issue. They have their head, in the sand. Nor do I think we should leave the binding CIR thing alone. If it's good enough for Switzerland, for God's sake, it's good enough for New Zealand. Let's face it. The Green Party have somehow been persuaded that binding CIR is a ticket for the corporates to rule New Zealand. And I keep arguing with them and saying, well, what the hell do you think is going on now?
Yeah, well, I actually read an article about the Switzerland situation, and they said that there was a lot of money spent by the corporates, and also background information that not many of the binding referendum actually passed, but this did, and by a sizable majority.
That's right. And despite the fact that the corporates spent so many millions of dollars to influence the people on this one.
Yeah.
You gotta say, hey, yes, indeed, there's going to be a lot of money spent to influence the people in referenda, okay? As there was here in West Auckland when the liquor lobby decided to spend a lot of money in West Auckland to allow supermarkets to sell booze, okay? They lost. In fact, when I did the research, I found that more times than not, the people voted against the corporates in the referenda that really mattered. In this country, of course, they throw us a sop, which is, oh, you can have a referendum, but it won't mean anything.
Yeah.
I think that's just typical or something. But back to the magazine.
Yes, back to the magazine.
What?
Yes, that's what I want to do.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we...
I want to talk about the abiotic oil thing.
Oh, my God. Let's do that. That's a good idea.
Yep, that links over from the 9/11 issue that we touched on before. A lot of people think it's fairly clear we're invading Iraq because we're at peak oil. The oil's running out. America wants to keep its hands on as much of the oil in the world as possible. But you're saying in your magazine that the whole theory of oil is in fact wrong. It's not a fossil fuel. It's abiotic, which means not from life. It's not a life-based oil. What's this all about, John?
What's it all about? What it's all about is, I don't really care if it's biotic or abiotic. Okay, I don't have any. I'm just an editor here. Okay, I track the story down. Whatever seems the most plausible after my research is the one that gets printed, and then if I'm wrong, fine, I'm wrong. Show me where I'm wrong, and I'll be happy to print a retraction or the other side, that kind of stuff. What got me started was this whole idea that the oil companies suddenly are telling the people the truth. I'm old enough to remember 1974 when the last time the oil was running out. We had, you know, the Carless days and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, everybody's running around the chicken with their head cut off and the oil's running out and the price is going up and all that sort of carry on. And people just don't remember that. That was 74, 75, I think. This time, I got into it a little bit more deeply, Aaron. And I thought, well, what's going on here? Is the residue of the sludge left by millions of dead dinosaurs, who most of whom happened to die in Saudi Arabia and Iraq, or is it something else? Now, in 1991, I read the Scientific American article by a guy named, I think his name is Thomas Gold, who did an experiment because he also, scientist that he was, wondered is it really coming from plant matter and dinosaurs, or could it be coming from the heat generated from the mantle of the Earth, the amazing pressures in the Earth itself, working on the naturally occurring carbon and other minerals? Okay,
but isn't that going against accepted scientific fact?
No, it doesn't go against. There is no accepted scientific fact here, Aaron. What you've got to understand is this dinosaur sludge idea came around in the 18th century and nobody tested it until 1991.
Okay, go on.
All right. Then I had, by the way, Gold went up to Sweden where no oil had ever been found, and he drilled down there in this experiment, and yes, indeed, he found oil. All right. The And that led him to, you know, they shut him up pretty quick. However, there was one group of people who didn't shut up really quick, and that was the Russians. At the end of World War II, the Russians were virtually without any oil. They had no oil wells, but they had a lot of smart guys over there in the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And they, too, had a close look at where the oil comes from, and they decided to sink a few very deep wells. By very deep, I mean 40,000 feet, or what, 10, 15,000 meters down, which is pretty deep.
That 10 or 15 kilometers.
Yeah, 8 miles.
8 miles, yeah. Eight miles, 15 kilometers. Yeah.
Yeah, right, thanks. And lo and behold, they found oil, and lots of it. Now, once again, I don't care if it's biotic or abiotic, but the Russians went from a zero oil producing country to the number one or number two, depending on the week, oil producing country in the world, on the basis of this so-called discredited theory. Now, they're making billions and billions of dollars and rubles and whatever they change with off of this discredited theory, so I'm going, oh, well, you know, it must be a fact. And besides which, they've done the same thing for Vietnam and other countries. And they have an oil field up there based on this abiotic theory, which is the most productive field, I forgot how you pronounce it in Russian, field in the world now. That's good enough for me until somebody comes along and tells me that it's all chimerical and the Russians aren't doing what everybody says they're doing. Now, to make matters more interesting, British Petroleum has just invested very heavily in this field, which is supposedly running out, according to the biotic theorists. But they've just put $15 billion into this field, and then there are the little asides like GeoTimes, which is the oil industry journal, which is now discovered for those who read these journals that a lot of the oil fields which were running out have been miraculously refilling over the last 15, 20 years. Apparently there are some invisible dinosaurs that go and die under these particular fields. They get converted pretty quickly into oil.
Okay, now we talked about this in a previous interview, and I wasn't ready for it. I didn't know much about it. I just had somebody on talking about peak oil,
yeah,
and the issues we were going to face. So and we had a discussion about it, and I went away and tried to find out some stuff. And in some ways, it's quite hard to find out because everything is based in Russia, and I don't read Russian, and I don't know my way around that sort of area.
That's why I published the translation.
Yeah, well, good. But the other thing is too for me is that I source a lot of information for my show from alternative news sources, some of which I like to think I can rely on. But these places are also pushing a lot of the peak oil.
Yeah, yeah,
peak oil has started off as an alternative news story. And
that's how they do it, Aaron. The whole idea behind this particular campaign was to get from the wilderness, for example. I presume that's one of your sources. Right?
I think I've broadcast a talk by Mike Rupert.
Rupert was the first one. The first one to go for, if you're going to do a campaign, these people are really smart. I mean, these disinformation specialists. Then you go for the alternatives, you go for the greens, you go for the people who get on board, who want the oil to be running out, and I certainly do, and you get them into this peak oil thing, and you know, I mean, the campaigns, disinformation campaigns, are very well thought out, except for the Iraqi one, which, you know, that was kind of, they left a trail of
truth was very self-evident.
But that's right. But if you get the Greens and Rupert and the alternatives going, hey, we got to prepare for yes, indeed, cheap oil probably is running out. Okay, but. You have to read the oil industry journals, Aaron. First of all, let's understand one thing very, very clearly. If you're a company and you're, say, an oil company and your oil's running out, what would that do to your share price? Any company. Say I'm in a handkerchief company and cotton's running out, or if I'm in the building industry and concrete's running out, all right? Your share price is going to reflect that. the oil industry share prices are through the roof and they're going higher and they've never been higher. All right? That should tell Jeanette Fitzsimons, Mike Rupert, and others something. It says to me that we should probably look further and read the oil industry journals themselves instead of relying on Mike Rupert. So that's what I did. Geotimes is not reporting peak oil. Geotimes is reporting the fact that thousands of oil fields around the world have been discovered and capped until such point as the price is can justify their uncapping. And by the way, several of those oil fields are right here in New Zealand.
Okay, I remember something in the Listener a few years ago that there was oil somewhere down on a farm in Taranaki and an American company was coming in.
They did.
To
that's
do some
right.
work on it, but I didn't hear any more from.
Yeah, that's right.
Then.
They found it, they capped it, and the same thing that they did in the Falklands. Can anybody remember that war in the Falklands, or the Malvinas, as the Argentinians call it? Yes, that was all about oil, too. They found heaps of oil in the Falklands, and they capped it. They found a estimated trillion barrel oil field in the Gulf of Mexico. Cap that. Chavez, the president of Venezuela, has announced to the world that they have 150 years of oil to supply to the entire world, that they know of. Okay.
He's that's like painting a target on your chest, isn't it? Doing that sort of thing.
Well, if the Russians, who are now the world's largest supplier of oil, are right, and I suspect very strongly that they are, the Geotimes is reporting now that the American oil companies and the British oil companies are seriously looking at deep drilling, and in fact are doing experimental deep drilling.
Is that right?
Yep.
Which is what the Russians have done, basically.
Which is what the Russians have done since 1950.
Yep.
Now, Mike Rupert can probably have a look at this, but he doesn't choose to. And I've read some debates between some of the geologists and Rupert. Rupert is a shill.
What's a shill, John, for those of us in the younger generations? A
shill is a front person.
Knowingly or unknowingly?
I have no idea. Whether he knows it or he doesn't know it, I don't respect his research anymore. I don't respect the fact that he said, maybe Cheney do it, but we should move on. I don't respect the fact that he's deflecting a lot of people who are, you know, otherwise independent thinkers. And, you know, he's sort of like the Judas goat.
Yep.
So that's my take on abiotic oil. I haven't been able to get the Greens to listen to that because, like myself, they would love to have the oil running out kind of thing. But what's the only thing that's happened with all of this scare thing is that the price of oil has gone through the roof. The American companies are not building any more refineries, and people are paying for it.
So where is it?
I would love it. Hey, by the way, I think that oil, you know, this whole oil thing has yet to be fully explored in terms of its relationship to the ozone hole, because every time you burn a drop of oil, you're creating carbon dioxide. In other words, you are tying up free oxygen. That oxygen would otherwise be forming into ozone, O3. And it cannot do that if you're burning these fuels. By the way, it's not fossil fuels.
Yep.
Never found a single fossil ever. I have a friend who's a geologist who worked in the Gulf of Mexico. She said we have never found a single fossil ever in any drop of oil. We find them on the way down to the oil, but we don't find them in the oil anywhere.
Is it also true? I seem to remember reading this that they find oil at depths a lot below the lowest fossil depth.
Oh yeah, of course. We're talking the 8 mile people too.
Yeah.
Ain't no fossils down there. But when you consider the fact that, let's see, what are the common elements in the Earth's crust? I mean mantle. Sorry. One of them is silica. One aluminium, right? And the third is carbon. Da 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 da. Carbon. You got hydrogen and carbon, and the silicates, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you have all this, fucking carbon, but I won't. If you have all this carbon under heat, and it's producing a lot of methane, by the way, you don't need biotic processes to produce methane. Yes, you will get some. You will get some biotic signatures on the way up, but you won't get it initially all the way down.
Okay, I'm still really curious about this. Why the alternative news sources have gone for this so much? I mean, is it really down just to the fact that everyone, most of them are environmentally oriented and would like it to be true?
I think so, Aaron. People just don't do their homework. There's just so much out there. You got to be 14 hours researching every day to get a handle on any of it, and which is why I do that, I suppose. Maybe I'm just hardwired to do it. But if you do your homework and you get both sides of the story, then you have a very it's not clear sailing, but you begin to detect some patterns. The first of which was that the oil companies have never told the truth about anything.
Yeah. Well, the one thing, like I said, I went and tried to do a little bit of research, not 14 hours a day like you do. The one thing I discovered that, yes, the whole Russian Academy of Sciences is, and the whole Russian scientific community is behind, you know, the abiotic theory. And when this was brought up with some of the peak oil experts, this was the thing that gave it away a little more. No, the thing that worried me a little bit was that the answers weren't entirely straight. They said things like, oh, well, it's only a minority of Russian scientists. but people who've been to Russia aren't agreeing with that.
It's not a minority of Russian scientists.
People who can speak Russian.
Yeah, it forms the basis of the entire oil industry in Russia. And that entire oil industry is now the biggest production in the world.
I'd like to talk to a Russian.
Yeah, good. I can turn you on to one.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe I'm just old school, but it seems like a no-brainer to me.
Okay, all right, let's move on. Something else you've got on the issue. The meningitis campaign, huge long article there detailing almost everything that I've heard and some more that I haven't about the meningitis campaign. Do you just want to give us a bit of background on that and why parents might want to read this?
Yeah, sure. It boils down to this. The Ministry of Health in New Zealand is in the pocket of the giant pharmaceuticals. The organization delegated to proclaim the safety of the vaccine was compromised financially by taking money, backhanders, if you will. This is IMAC, Immunization Awareness, something. And they claim to be associated with the university. They may or may not be. Anyhow, they had a financial stake in the vaccine at the same time that they were declaring that it was safe. The testing wasn't rigorous. The company that produced the vaccine was had its operation shut down for another vaccine, but you know, nevertheless, a shoddy operation in England. What can I tell you?
What about people being hurt, injured by this, made sick by this vaccine? Is that happening?
Yeah, the thing about vaccines, though, is that while you get what they call adverse reactions in the near term, that is to say shortly after the vaccine, most of them don't show up for months, if not years later, as we've seen in, some of the other vaccines. The only testing that they did for the adverse events, adverse reactions, was, according to their own package insert, was only up to, and I quote, up to 7 days. And the last thing to be reminded of is that they hung their whole hat on what they called the Norwegian parent vaccine, which they claimed showed that their vaccine was safe because it was derived from the Norwegian vaccine, which was proved to be safe. Well, the fact of the matter is that the Norwegian vaccine was not only unsafe and had a huge problem with adverse events, but wasn't effective and was never used on the whole as a general rollout in the population in Norway. Basically, that was a scandal that should never have happened.
Well, the Ministry of Health has used quite an emotive campaign. I mean, I've heard stories from parents around town here about their small children, you know, talking 5, 6, 7 years old, being freaked out at school by people coming along to tell them how dangerous it is and coming home and demanding that they have the vaccine.
Right, yep.
I mean, what's going on here? I mean, why aren't people upset about that? Or maybe they are, and we just don't hear about it.
Well, for me, that whole campaign was tantamount to child abuse. Scaring the shit out of the little kids who then go home and pressure their parents, who are being pressured anyhow by a huge PR campaign was entirely emotive and was basically pushed by a medical establishment that's riddled with scandal. The thing is totally corrupt, and they don't give a shit who they hurt.
Okay, so people can go read Uncensored magazine or go to the website uncensored.co.nz.
Yeah, it's an excellent article by a guy named Jason Sanders, and we spent weeks and weeks corroborating every single factual item in that article. Weeks, because we knew that we'd take a lot of stick from it, so we knew that we had better get every comma, every fact in that article spot on.
And have you taken a lot of stick for it?
No. Basically, what happened was the ministry either ignored us or directly or spent even more money on more campaigns and more buses and placards and radio and TV to scare more people into and then this complete moron Jane O'Hallahan or whatever her name is goes on TV and says, look, it's working. The number of meningococcal cases has declined substantially in Manukau, which was the heaviest hit. Without once referencing Ron Law, their former expert consultant, who pointed out quite correctly to them that the decline in the cases of meningococcal disease went down 70% prior to the introduction of this vaccine. End of story.
Yeah.
The woman's corrupt. Let her sue me.
She's the head of the campaign for the Ministry of Health.
Was one of the spokeswomen. She's another one with a doctor in front of her name. These people are shameless. They just are absolutely shameless in corrupting the facts and pushing absolute crap on the people with a lot of money and good graphics behind them.
A lot of money and good graphics.
Yeah.
Okay, now we were, the other day when I rang you up to confirm the interview, we were actually talking about other health issues.
By the way, are we on the air now?
Yeah.
Oh, just kidding. Sorry.
We were talking about, or I was talking about the fact, like, I've got small children under fives and they're getting sick a lot, and a lot of the parents talk about that. And you basically said, read the article about chemtrails in the first issue. And chemtrails, I hadn't read much about it. I'd sort of vaguely heard about it, but I didn't know much about it, and I suspect most people won't know much about it either. So do you want to give us a background on chemtrails? Tell us what the heck this is.
Chemtrails... The chemtrail phenomenon goes back about 9 years. It's part of a U.S. Black budget operation that's part of something called Operation Cloverleaf, which has ostensibly four components to it, hence Cloverleaf, you know, four, yeah. Essentially what they're doing is using white unmarked aircraft, even over New Zealand, as well as now some commercial aircraft to spray high altitude at high, very very high altitudes, to spray a noxious combination of micronized barium, aluminium, an assortment cocktail of nasty little viruses and nanobacteria and or mycoplasmas. In a soup of bovine erythrocytes are red blood cells, to which apparently nourish the little nanobacteria. Basically, what we're witnessing is a systemic degradation of the global human immune system.
Is that the point of?
Yeah. I think the point is what we call the depop agenda, which is to basically degrade the immune system and cull the human population to a more manageable, according to some theorists, a more manageable number. I think I've seen the number being 900 million people.
Just taking this theory for a second, wouldn't the people who are doing this, the spraying of it, also be susceptible to this?
Yeah, you would think so, yep.
Okay, just wondering. It doesn't make a lot of sense for that.
No, it certainly doesn't.
But you're saying that this is happening nonetheless.
Well, these are all out there. These are documented facts. Oh, there's another call coming in. I'll put you on hold for a minute. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
Good.
What?
Good.
I just wanted to see if you'd take me seriously there for a minute.
I was getting ready to put some music on.
I'm
ready for that. Don't worry.
Okay. So, since the 1970s, at the very earliest, one has seen articles from elite organizations declaring that there are too many people, we have to do something about it. What we're not going to do is birth control. What we are going to do is, degrade the human immune system and produce all sorts of weaponized, mycoplasmas to cause diseases around the world. There's very good evidence that the AIDS epidemic was biowarfare against the human population. But that apparently hasn't worked fast enough for the elite, so they want to do a little bit faster. So 9 years ago, they initiated this Operation Cloverleaf. If you think I'm a paranoid loony, you're entitled to your opinion. However, all you have to do is go and have a look at, go Google up a guy named Eastland, E-A-S-T-L-U-N-D, and you'll see his patents in the United States Patent Office, unless they've taken those out now, detailing the ways that you can spray all these noxious chemicals and all these germs on the population of the world. Also, let me remind our listeners here that in a 2004 candidate for president in the Democratic primaries, an honorable man by the name of Denis Kucinich, K-U-C-I-N-I-C-H. He did very, very well in the primaries against Kerry and those other candidates, and Denis Kucinich, as a congressman, introduced a bill to outlaw chemtrailing. 3 days later, after the introduction of his bill, he was leaned on very heavily, and he withdrew it.
But there's still a record of him
trying
to introduce that.
There's still the record, yes, yep. Sir. Now, if this congressman, an honorable man, and candidate for president, thinks that they're chemtrailing and they're up to no good, well, there you go. But he had that bill that he introduced in the United States Congress, and he not only did that, but part of that same bill was to outlaw weather modification for weapons purposes.
Do you talk about weather modification in here? I might have.
No, but I'm going to
New issue. Okay, all right. We'll talk about that a bit later. What I do want to ask you about, though, is given this chemtrail situation and degradation of the immune system, is there some way people could defend themselves, boost the immune system?
I would say, yeah.
What would they do?
Well, you just go on the net and find out the ways to boost your immune system. But clearly, there's an agenda out there, and it's not very friendly to individuals and families alike. It's very friendly to drug companies because people, as with this Tamiflu thing, people are getting themselves manipulated into a panic, and then are going to their doctors and chemists and pharmacists to get the solution. This is by the way. The one of the chief shareholders in the company that's getting the royalties from Tamiflu is none other than our friend Donald Rumsfeld.
No big surprise when you think about it.
No, it isn't. Yeah. Of course, you know...
Sorry, that's not very objective of me, is it?
I'm a conspiracy theorist, but that doesn't mean I'm wrong.
You should get that on a T-shirt.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
Right. All right, now look, we've probably done enough time here. I know there's other things in the first issue, like the color of the sky on Mars is actually blue, and depleted uranium, health hazard in Iraq and for troops, and all the dangers of toothpaste.
Yeah, well, that depleted uranium is a real, real good story. We're doing it, the Americans are doing it to their own troops, okay? And they did it in the first Gulf War. And you got a 500,000 troops from the first Gulf War who are walking basket cases now, okay? And yet the Pentagon doesn't do anything about it. You got to ask yourself, why is that? If you think that the Americans don't do it to themselves, just ask yourself what happened. What about those 500,000 basket cases from the 1991 war?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, John, tell us what's coming up in the next issue, which is due out in what, a week or two?
Oh, I don't know. As soon as we're done. Yeah, look for it. I guess before Christmas.
Okay.
But in the new issue, in the coming issue. Well, we take a lighter look at the growing menace of American Nazification.
What does that mean?
It means that the Americans are the Americans are turning their country into a Stasi zone. But that's something that you'll just have to read. But the most interesting story that I think we're publishing is the discovery of ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics from a very little known period in the history of ancient Egypt, and these hieroglyphics were found in Australia.
Australia?
Yeah.
Okay.
This dovetails with the discovery of some ocean-going vessels that they found in Egypt a few years ago. And people have been wondering where the hell they use these boats to go to, and this is a good one. And there's a translation of the hieroglyphics there. To me, that's the most fascinating story in the whole thing. We're also running a story on the Battle of L.A. from 1942, which nobody knows about, and that is. In 1942, hundreds of thousands of people looked up at 2 o'clock in the morning when they heard the guns going off, the sirens and the searchlights. And what did they see? They saw all the searchlights focused on the giant UFO and all the anti-aircraft batteries unloading salvo after salvo at this giant craft that was just hovering there in the sky.
So Uncensored Magazine does UFOs as well.
Well, anything, man. If it's a good story and it's not in the mainstream and it can be shown to be true. And by the way, this made the front page of the Los Angeles Times the very next day, and the Army admitted that it was real. Okay?
Okay. Now, there is something. I was going to ask you this question if you brought up UFOs, because I knew you might. People will be thinking, and I know that people always have this reaction, no serious journalist investigates things like UFOs.
Yeah, I know. What a pity, huh? It's the biggest story never covered.
Okay, so it doesn't... Yeah, I guess this comes to the heart of why journalists stay inside the box.
That's right.
It doesn't bother you that people are going to be saying, well, clearly the guy's a conspiracy nut now. He chases UFOs. I mean,
Come
on, people are saying.
Hey, look, Aaron, I don't give a shit what they think. If the story is true, we'll run it. Okay? That's it. I also have an interview conducted in 1899 with Nikola Tesla. Most people don't even know who the hell Nikola Tesla was. Do you?
Yeah, I read your book.
Okay, there you go. Here we have a case in 1942, which was corroborated by the United States Army, which the General George Marshall, who was the Chief of Staff of the United States Army in 1942, says it's real, and we've put together a secret committee to deal with this because we think it might not be of this earth. The Army sends up thousands of shells, six people die, and it's the front page big story in the Los Angeles Times. Okay, I'm going to run it. I don't care if they think I'm a conspiracy nut or what. If the story is true, I'm going to run it.
Okay. Where can people get the next edition?
And I don't know. They're local news dealers.
It's out everywhere, like in Wick Coles, everywhere you can get a newspaper.
They're petrol stations, the dairies, I don't know, Wickles. It's very important here in New Zealand to not be afraid of what other people think. If you should stand your ground if you got your facts together, and never mind what they say about you. It's more important to feel good about yourself inside, to know that what you're writing and speaking and thinking was the truth, and if you made a mistake, to admit it and go on and retract it. I have yet to be shown that I'm wrong. Jeremy Wells can roll his eyes all he wants to, but if I've got the facts, fine. I feel that that's all I really need.
Okay, John. Well, that's a good place to end it.
Yeah.
Thanks heaps for your time, and maybe we'll talk to you again about something astounding in the next issue.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Thanks for that, Aaron, and thanks for paying for the phone call.
Yeah. No problem, John.
Cheers.
See ya.
Bye-bye.